Good morning. This is Jeff J. Brown, Radio Sinoland in Taiwan Province, China. And I've got a woman on the show tonight, or tonight for her in California today, who I really respect and admire, Teresa Caraggio. How are you doing, Teresa?
I'm doing excellent. So happy to be talking to you, Jeff.
And I didn't realize, but I had her on my show in January of 2023 to discuss her book, and so I thought, and I do subscribe to her Substack, and I enjoy what she I enjoy and appreciate the work that she does. So I contacted her, and she agreed to get back on the show. Let me just give you a an intro. And you will, I guarantee you will be fascinated with her boundless knowledge, enthusiasm, and optimism to create a better world for the 99%. Teresa Caraggio is the author of How to Dismantle an Empire, which is the book that we reviewed in 2023, and the creator of Third Paradigm on YouTube, Substack, Rumble, and Locals. Topics include small-scale sovereignty, the Great Reset, global geopolitics, global economics, propaganda and censorship, A Course in Miracles, women, anthropology, socio-spirituality, education, power, and money. And I will include in on her interview page her website, her book link, her Substack, and her email. So, I know you all are going to enjoy a great show. Thank you for being on, Teresa.
So happy to be here.
Well, listen, what I decided to do is I just pitched Teresa this topic. Five topics Teresa Caraggio worries about because the homies don't know what's really going on. And so she came up with three and then a surprise one at the end.
No, I have five. I have all five.
But then you say I'll have one bonus.
And a bonus.
And a
Five
bonus,
plus a
yeah,
bonus.
five plus a bonus. So I'm just going to let you take it away. I might jump in and ask a question or two, but take it away, Ms. Caraggio.
Okay. So the way that I thought about that, it was such a great prompt because it gave me so many interesting things to think about. And what I decided to do is think about it as here are the positions that I've come to, the conclusions that my research has led me to. And then I have issues that will back up each one of these. So the first one is there is always another psyops.
Okay.
So let's start with the psyops du jour, the Charlie Kirk assassination. So that one, I posted 2 days after it on the Charlie Kirk psyops. And at that time, the question that I posed, I figured that there was no one who was in my audience who was going to be buying the lone gunman with the transgender partner, that was too obvious. So the two that I look at as which one was real was Israel did it, and two, nobody did it because it didn't happen.
Okay. I read that. I read your article.
Yes. So in that, I quoted Laurent Guillaume, who posts on UNTZ and also his own Substack, and he did the best compilation that I'd seen of all of the different evidence that it was Israel, that it was Bibi who did it. And so he kept going back and he kept adding more to it and really made a very compelling case for that. And then I posted all the information saying, well, here's all the evidence that just doesn't add up. And my readers kept on adding even more videos to go to, showing that the ballistics were just not realistic. Of course, I think we all know about the moving shirt that's going on, and then the no exit wound, and is it going from that direction? And then you look at the fact that if a bullet's coming this way, why does he fall in the direction that he's just been hit? It would make sense for that to have pushed him in the opposite direction, unless there needs to be the squib that is pouring out the blood from that way. So all of those kept going on. And then I also looked at Erica Kirk and her speech at the memorial was so pre-planned and so unrealistic. Someone named Mira AF did a piece saying that when you have these kinds of events that are planned, you can't make them real and count on the loved ones responding in the way that you want them to, according to the script, because people are unpredictable. And so the only way to get that kind of response, where she's essentially giving a pitch for Charlie's organization, is to make sure that she's in on the plot.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And then
Absolutely.
the thing that I just recently looked at was one of my readers sent me to footage that had the SUV, and it has them loading him into the SUV in a completely amateur way. One, so I, as I mentioned, my son-in-law is looking to become a firefighter, and so he's an EMT now, and he could verify that you never take a gunshot victim or anyone with a neck wound, and then cart them into an SUV, jostle them around. You're going to stabilize them. You're going to make sure you get blood, into them. You're going to make sure you're tracking all their vital signs. So I look at the footage of that, where one person is pointing her camera completely away, and that no one is supporting his head. That they're carrying him by his arms and his torso, and he's holding up his own head. Exactly. Yes. You can't possibly have someone with a neck wound who is,
Supporting his own head,
supporting his own
and
head.
who's supposed to be already dead.
Exactly right. Yes. So that all falls apart. But here's the deeper question. Here's the psyops within the psyops. Was Charlie questioning Israel part of the whole setup? Because now he's been made a martyr both to the anti-Israel group and he's been made a martyr to the pro-Israel group. So they've created these conditions where both sides are saying, oh, yeah, he was on our side. And they're both buying into it because it supports what they want to support. So that neither side is really questioning, did this even happen? And why are they setting us up to feel that he was questioning Israel? I mean, they certainly need to have somebody who's on that, who's a conservative, because conservative Republicans under, I think it is 27, or I think under 30, that 20, only 27% of them support Israel. So you have the entire other 77% who are all needing to have somebody who's speaking out against Israel. Otherwise, they're all going to flock somewhere else or start their own party. So they need to cover that, but they need to make sure they're covering it with someone who is controlling that opposition.
Of course, that's what they do.
Right.
They create a conflict and then they create a controlled opposition and manage it.
Yes. Yes, and one of my episodes looks at that as sheepdogs that are rounding up the strays, the ones who escaped the first circle of psyops, and then they're sending them back to the slaughterhouse by a different route that they call freedom.
Yeah. What do you think? I mean, I'm 90% sure that Jeffrey Epstein is still alive, and it's very possible that Charlie Kirk is still alive. What do they do with the? I mean, do they? I guess they must get plastic surgery and they change their IDs, and
Well,
are they
so
locked? Are they locked in a dungeon? Or I mean, I just don't know what happens to them.
I know it, and it seems to me that those people, especially Jeffrey Epstein, he's only a liability. So we know that they've got no problem killing their own.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So I don't think that assassination happened there, but is it possible that it happened later?
Yeah. Well, the devil's advocate is that if they're wiping out everybody that's been a good asset for at least for a while, no one will be an asset anymore because they know they're going to get a bullet in the back of the head. I just wonder if maybe they're in a safe house someplace and they've got, 20, they're basically in house arrest and they're going nowhere, and
Yeah.
they're guarded 24/7. They still let them live. But yeah, I saw a graphic on Charlie Kirk's wife. I mean, she was Trump's Miss Arizona. I mean,
Right.
she's Trump. I mean, she is an insider. Her whole family is tied into the master race and the Jewish state,
Right.
and child, trafficking in Romania. I mean,
Right.
she is a real piece of work.
I was just seeing that one of the other runner-ups for Miss Arizona in the Trump pageant was is now the Assistant Attorney General for Virginia, I think it
Oh
is.
my God.
Yeah. Yeah, so that is all just the recruiting grounds. Yeah. And
Unbelievable.
I think that we do need to look at mind control and the whole monarch program
Yeah.
and how much women are a part of that and used to control the men and to make sure that they do not go rogue.
Tell us for the fans out there, and actually for me, I've kind of forgotten now. What is the mon? That's a Mossad, CIA, MI6 program. What is it about Monarch?
Yeah, I think actually it's Illuminati
Oh, the
that,
Illuminati. Okay.
yeah, I think, but
Okay.
it is again one where young girls are groomed from the beginning in order
Okay.
to both be honeypots and lure in men, but then also to make sure that they are the ones who are keeping them under control and that they are also completely obedient.
Okay. All
And
right.
Melania Trump is a pretty obvious one.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, unfortunately, they control the media. And so, I mean, it's just like a marionette. They just control the media, and it's just people like you who, get the truth, at least options for the truth,
Right.
and but I think that and also, Trump's supposed assassination attempt in Pennsylvania, that was such an obvious false flag. I mean, it was
Someone.
so badly done. I mean, it was just like Charlie Chaplin, and a slapstick comedy, and people fall for it because the media just in unison just, comes out with the big lie, and everybody just falls in line, like you say, sheeple. They're just sheeple.
Someone was just writing about the great ear, and I was like, oh yes, it's the best ear. It's the only presidential ear that has ever been so successful. Just those
Yeah. And
Trumpisms.
also the supposed assassin at his golf course, with his gun through the bushes, You're trying to tell me that guy got, with all of his security detail everywhere he goes surrounding the golf course, and you're telling me this guy walks into the golf course with a gun. This is, but unfortunately, Teresa, it works. It works. It's just depressing, but it works. What do you think?
I think that it is going in a direction that it needs to go,
Okay.
but I don't believe that in the long run it's going to work.
Okay.
I think that we are reaching a culmination, and that brings me into the next of my
Five topics. Take it away,
five topics.
Teresa. Take it away.
The second is, it is a 5,000-year-old death cult. No more, no less. So, when you and I last talked, we talked about my book,
Yep.
How to Dismantle an Empire. And in that, I look at money and I go back 3,500 years. And I go back to the origins of democracy and how that was a trick that made it where hierarchy replaced what they really wanted, what the people really wanted, which was anarchy, which was to get rid of the archons who were ruling over them rather than creating kind of a ladder so that the wealthy could become archons. Right now, I'm working on a book called Oh My Goddess. And in that one, I go back 5,000 years because what I'm trying to figure out is where did the Archon start? What was the first time that we ended up having this hierarchy? And what I found is that this word Aryan that has been misconstrued to mean all white people actually meant the rulers, that the original spelling of Aryan, the air in it was H-E-I-R. They were the one heirs, and they're the ones who in Egypt in 3150 before the Common Era created these archons that they put into place who all answered to the one heir. And so it has been the Aryans who are just this tight little class of people who all answer to the same place, who have been the ones who not only introduced that political concept, but also have written all of the religions, all of the major religions, and have changed the languages that going into that at the by the end of World War I, linguists were talking about this. They talked about how all of these came from Aryan. They're all Aryan languages. And then when the word Aryan got intentionally changed, it became Proto-Indo-European. So in order to really understand what's going on today, I think we have to go all the way back and say, what are the techniques that were used way back then in order to make us obedient, in order to turn us all into slaves? That if you look at a pyramid, it is a perfect control system because the person at the top doesn't need to control everybody. They control the four that are right below them. And then they each control four, and then they each control four, and everyone's so preoccupied with trying to move up that next level that they never look at the fact that we could bring that whole thing down. And so that's what I feel we are missing if we're only looking at, say, the last 200 years or 500. And on the other side, if we go all the way back and say things have always been this way and therefore they're always going to be this way, that wasn't true from what my research is showing, that there was a time that is pre-archy, pre-archons.
When are you going to publish your book, Teresa?
I'm still on the second chapter, and
Okay. I'm being presumptuous.
it's going to be a while, but I am finding out so much about Egypt. So it's looking at goddess cultures and looking at ancient Egypt and finding out that what we call the Sphinx is actually goes back 12,000 years, and that the pharaoh face on it was recarved, that it was the lioness Mehet, who was the goddess in lioness form, and that the pharaohs defaced it. They just took the head and they carved
A pharaoh's head on it,
the pharaoh's head on it.
and then Napoleon blew off its nose.
Oh, is that who? I wondered where who blew off
Supposedly, yeah, supposedly
that
that may be myth, but supposedly they were. They shot a cannon at it and grazed its nose and knocked it off. So,
Well,
go ahead. Go
with
ahead,
looking
Teresa.
at everything that they did, that those archons did to, and they came from Aeropolis. So even the name Air, Heir, is in the place that they came from
Okay.
and had different levels of people who did different things. So in Anatolia, I believe they picked up the Luwians, who become the Levites in the Torah.
Yeah.
So they become the ones who are the linguists and who are able to write all of these myths that again give you that sense that there is one heir, that God has, that one God is a man, and that that man has created everyone and has only one heir that is special.
Yeah. Being here in China, and I just. And I, you just see, I mean, I over the last few years, I have just come to realize, at least in my opinion, that the West has a defective DNA. It's just, it's mutated, it's corrupted, and we don't have this problem in China. We don't, we have Confucius, we have Buddha, we have Lao Tzu. We have the golden rule. We have Confucius's five constants, kindness, justice, courtesy, wisdom, and trust. And those five constants are what Chinese culture is based on, Chinese civilization is based on, going back exactly to your 5,000 years. And so it's just like night and day, and you really can't see. Well, you're seeing it because you're a smart lady who's willing to, expand your arc of awareness. But for but for me, I had to get into China and learn, learn Chinese and understand Chinese culture to see the Western. The Western, how the West presents itself and how the West has evolved. And it's I don't know how to get, well, your book's a good start, but and I saw, you, the Greeks took Egyptian slavery, then they went up to Mesopotamia and took the and took usury and expansionism. And when was it? And then when the Abraham went down, south, he took the usury, but he left off the debt forgiveness. So it's just the way, there's no debt forgiveness. And then in 1500, they convinced the Pope to allow compound interest. And it's just, I don't know what I just I the West, I think, has got to almost be completely reformed to have any chance of survival. That may be a bit too doomsday, but that's the way I'm feeling sitting here in, Taiwan, China.
So this may bring me into my third principle,
Sure.
which is that arguing is thinking together, and that we need to have disagreements, productive disagreements, with the people with whom we're on the same side. And so I have different rules for have a better argument. The first one is like the person you're arguing with, because otherwise, what's the point? And then I look at define the question. And three, explain all the terms and what they mean to you in that question. And then four, why does it matter? Because some of the times I think that we end up arguing about things that are what Margaret Anna Alice calls fissure issues, that they're things that take people who are on the same side and they separate them. And other times, I think that we argue about things that actually clarify what side you're on, because as I've said, there's only two sides. There's empire and sovereignty. And sometimes people can seem like they're on the same side on one issue. And then when you actually get down to it, you find that they think of themselves as superior to other people, and that you realize that they're not really on your side if you're on the side of sovereignty. They're really on the side of empire. They just want it to be an empire they're in charge of. They don't really have a problem with the concept. They just have a problem with like who's in charge.
They want to move up that pyramid.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. So the reason that I thought about that is because in what you're saying, like there are a few things that I would differ on. For one, I have an article on the Golden Rule rant. So, the original, what had been for millennia, the principle is what I call the rule of reciprocity, which is anything that would be wrong for someone else to do to you is wrong for you to do to them. In the Bible, it gets turned into this golden rule, which is don't do to anyone else. What or no, that you should do to other people what you would want them to do to you. So that's kind of nonsense. Like I might like everybody to give me their money, but I'm not gonna do that. It by turning it into rather than here's what's wrong, that instead it says, okay, here's what you need to do, otherwise you're wrong. And that turned the most basic principle of ethics into something that was nonsense, that was no longer something that could be used in a court. Like if we were looking at Palestine today, of course, and we say, okay, if it would be wrong for someone to do those things to people in Israel, then obviously, it is wrong for them to do those things to people in Palestine. Then that would be obvious. But once it gets turned into, you need to do to others what you want them to do to you, then it gets twisted.
That's really interesting that you bring that up, Teresa, because of course, the Golden Rule in China goes back thousands of years, and it's the foundation of governance. The emperor lives by the emperor Xi Jinping, Mao Zedong. You just go back and just all the way back, and it's really interesting because the Golden Rule in Chinese is negative. Don't do unto others what you do not want done to you. And so that's much more passive. That's much
Yes.
more,
Yes.
that's much, that's not proactive. That's passive.
Yes.
And I think maybe, and you just for the, and I always wondered why. And now I think you maybe answered the question. And
Right. Yes, that's exactly. It makes so much sense when
yeah,
you put it that way.
in the
But
negative.
in the negative, but in the positive, which is usually what the Bible refers to it as
Yeah.
the golden rule, it is put in the positive, which turns it into nonsense.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, I'm
And
gonna
then,
go ahead.
well, another thing you mentioned was usury. So, because economics is my main thing, what I've looked at is that the word usury has been changed. The word usury has become about interest, when really usury and usurped are clearly related. And what our banking system does is that it usurps ownership of the house. You could not create credit for your neighbor's house. It wouldn't mean anything. But you could create credit, like you could let somebody buy your house and say, okay, I'll let you pay me over time if you pay me like a little bit more. And that would be valid. What the banks are doing is, without putting anything of value in, they're usurping the ownership of the houses. And so that's actually the problem. And as you know from my book, if we as communities took back ownership of those homes, I actually think that an interest rate is a good thing, because a higher interest rate keeps the cost of the house low. When I bought this house, the interest rate was almost 20%. And because everything's competitive, we're bidding against each other for how much debt we can incur and repay. And so if there's a high interest rate, that means that, for this amount that you can pay every month, you can the cost of the house can only be here. But if that interest rate drops to here, that means that the cost of the house can go way up, so that if you come into some savings, you can't pay off that mortgage, because that mortgage is sky high because of the interest rate. And you also can't give people a return on their savings. So that if we were designing our own economies and we wanted to be able to encourage people to save up, put it down a good down payment, put money into their own savings so that they can get interest and retire, that all of those, you definitely want to have a stable interest rate. These variable rates are just out there to turn people upside down and shake them and get, everything back out of their pockets. But if you have a stable interest rate, it actually, I think, is good to have it a little bit higher, because it keeps the cost of the housing down.
Well, that the variable interest rates is what caused my wife's and my bankruptcy in 2008. Everybody was doing it, and so you start out low, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's five times more than what it was. And that's why we lost everything in 2008, was because of the subprime variable interest rate.
Right. And I remember,
I call it the rape of the middle class.
completely. And I remember you telling me that. And it isn't just that everyone's doing it. You don't have a choice. If you're bidding against someone else for the same house, and they do a variable rate and you do a fixed rate that is, several points higher, you can't compete. Because if you have the same income that they have, they're going to get the house. So in order to, so it tricks us so that everyone has to get a variable rate. And it's not just individuals. The same is true for cities, for counties, for school
A lot
systems.
of them went bankrupt.
Well, because they bought that, you probably remember from my book on the chapter on Detroit, It Takes a Pillage, that with these derivatives, What they did was that they got the variable rate so that they could get the debt to fix their water system, which is what Detroit was doing. And then they bought into these derivatives, which was a kind of insurance. And so that if the variable rate went up, then the insurance paid it off, paid it down. But if it went down, then the insurance got the extra. And these were, of course, hedge funds. These were not just anybody, the same banks that they got the loans from. And so what they did, like if you remember back to the LIBOR rate and when they talked about, oh yeah, they're popping champagne, and why are they doing that when they faked it so that the interest rate was higher? Like why would that be a good thing for the bankers? The reason is that by that interest rate going higher, it meant that they then got the they or I think it went down, that they then got the bonuses from all those
From the
cities,
derivatives.
but the debt and the derivatives were tied to a different index, and that index did not go down. So they ended up owing hundreds and hundreds of thousands and millions, and they had no way of repaying it because they had to pay a year's worth of revenue just to get out of the deal. So it's not just individuals. They have all of us by the neck with those variable interest rates, and there's no reason for them.
Absolutely. Well, everybody should read Teresa's book. I will put her interview from 2020, January 2023, on her interview page. You should read it. I did read it, and it's back in storage in France. I couldn't bring all my hundreds of books here to China.
Well,
So,
now on my Substack, I've been reading it chapter by chapter and posting the chapters in the text. So I will be soon doing chapter 22. So I'm
I've
almost to
seen
the
that.
end of the book. So, yeah, so the entire book will be available online. And at that point, I'm also will be putting it out in as an ebook and making that available.
Oh, so
So.
you haven't done an ebook yet?
I haven't.
Okay. You
Yeah.
can also do an
Yeah.
audio, you can also do an audio book with Google, but I know that, and I did all three of, I did the China trilogy and Google Audio. But they fought me tooth and nail. I mean, they obviously don't like what I write about China, and can't say anything nice about China, and so they've been heavily shadow banning me and censoring me, and they stopped my audio account, and then I have to go back and complain, and then they start it back up. And but you may have better luck. And but yeah, audio, you can get audiobooks done, and it's not that difficult. I can send you the information if it's something you're interested in.
That would be great. And now that I have all of the videos, which of course have the audio with them,
Yeah,
I
exactly.
can
The
also
audio,
take those and
it'd
turn
be very
those.
interesting. It'd be very, very easy for you. And it would be in your own voice. I picked out, my voice was Michael. I picked out some guy named Michael on the list of names, and American Midwest or something like that. So, what's your fourth topic, Teresa? This is wonderful.
So the fourth topic is it takes a network to undermine an empire. And here is where I feel like the homies are not getting it. The example I'm going to use is cryptocurrencies. So I think that everyone should be doing whatever they think will work in order to make the transition from what's going on now to the next stage. I have no practical advice for people, but I take exception to the idea that that's going to solve it for everyone. That in order for us to be able to have a reciprocal economy, going back to my rule of reciprocity, as my version of the golden rule, that reciprocity is, I think, the system, the economic system that we need, and that having the money from those mortgages, once the community owns it, my system puts that back out into the community so that it can continue to circulate and it can boost our self-reliance. So I think that rather than going to something that is anonymous, where your money can go and do whatever you want it to do and nobody ever knows, that my plan is the opposite direction. My plan says you want to buy from people you have a relationship with. And maybe that's halfway around the world with, what I call sibling communities, where we have relationships between my little commonwealth and another commonwealth that's in China or, somewhere else. But everything that you do is building that relationship that you want to be buying from and selling to people that you know and people that you want to support. That's the kind of internet and communications that I'd like to see, and the kind of economy.
Yeah, it's really the things that you're telling me remind me so much about, comparing and contrasting China. The Westerners love to criticize the Chinese because, and this is also true in Thailand, and in fact, it's true in East Asia for the most part, but everything is based on Guanxi. And Guanxi is connections. Guanxi is relationships. And that goes for, family, friends. Who you went to college with is a big deal in China. You stay in touch with your college friends for your life. I mean, you have now become like a cohort of cooperation, and they help each other. And of course, the Confucian family, everything is based on family, father, mother, the oldest sibling down to the youngest sibling. And that, the Westerners that were so obsessed with, the Marlboro man, the being independent and free and do whatever I want to do and fuck everybody else. And that didn't work. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And of course, the Marlboro Man is a myth. We all depend on other people to take a step forward. And what you're talking about is actually very, very Chinese, and it's very active, and it's happening right now. I mean, and we now have Guanxi here in Taiwan, and we have friends here. We depend on them. They help us. We help them. So it's much, much more cooperative and cohesive, much more, cohesive and collaborative, I think, than the West. And I think we can see the difference today.
Yeah, and I think there's a way in order to put in the best of both worlds where you have the flexibility to be able to make choices and you have a system so that you're not necessarily depending on goodwill, that there is a calibrated system of saying, okay, here's what I have and I can do this for you and you will do this for me, and that is something that can scale up so that it involves an entire community.
Well, you're a great thinker, Teresa. Tell us about point number five.
Point number five is money is the means. But the occult is the end. And that's something that I think more and more people are coming to recognize, but it's so counter to how we've thought that we've thought, okay, this is all about profits. It's all about getting as much money as possible. But they don't need to get that money because they create the money. So the money is just the means of being able to usurp our labor, that once they own the houses, then everyone who has a roof over their head is in some way working for those oligarchs. But they're doing things that make no sense in terms of just profits. And that's where I think the worst things coming along have to do with this idea of sacrifice, especially burnt offerings. That when I look at Maui and Lahaina, that was clearly an occult sacrifice. It wasn't just about getting the property. That was definitely a perk, but it wasn't the entire reason for it. And I look at things like North Carolina here and the floods, and it's very interesting that that was Hurricane Helene, because going back to my research, it wasn't actually the Greeks who did all that. It was the Hellenes. And the Hellenes, again, came from Egypt with Heliopolis, that they were the ones who ended up destroying the indigenous Greeks. So everywhere that they've gone, they've usurped all of this. That it's part of that plan. And that's where I wonder too, with the biggest psyops of all is Palestine and what would have been called back then Canaan. And that's this greater Israel project. But even the name Israel is a psyops because it combines the name Isis and Ra and El. Those were all goddess names or consorts of the goddess. And so they took that history and made it mean something that was completely the opposite. But I even wonder whether the end game involves the sacrifice of Israel, that there is no concern right now for how much people are turning against Israel. That seems to be just fine with them. And I think that that's another that, if something were to happen, I think for one, they keep goading Iran. And Iran, of course, means land of the Aryans, that was their stomping ground for a millennia or more. So I think Iran now is being goaded to do something that will justify, in their mind, a retaliation. And I have to admire Iran that they're being very temperate and they're not falling for that way that they're being goaded.
Yeah, it's too bad they didn't finish off Israel, and they could have done it. I've seen photos of what Iran did to the Jewish state, and it's just they flattened that country. 50% of that country was destroyed, and they could have finished them off. And but then a Muslim friend of mine, I asked him. I said, "Why did they stop? They were winning." And he said, "Well, Israel declared that it was not going to fight anymore. And in the Quran, God command, Allah commands that if your enemy stops fighting, then you cannot continue to fight them." And I'm just like, "Oh my God, pardon the pun." And it's just like, so, and I think, another confrontation is inevitable. The Europeans with their snapback, and it's forever wars. It's just, that's the way it works. That's the way the West survives, is with forever wars. And so there will be another confrontation. And I hope this time they ignore the Quran and flatten the Jewish state, and because it's got to go. It's a cancer. It's a cancer on the human race, and it's the Torah, it's the Talmud. This is all religious prophecy going back thousands of years, and And you brought up some very interesting aspects too, which I find fascinating.
Yeah.
So, anyway, what is your surprise fifth point? No, sixth, sixth.
Sixth,
Yeah,
the bonus sixth.
I do this. This means six, and this means six in Chinese.
I know you're just in part of the Illuminati. It's just all that signaling going on, and I'm here on top of my black and white checked rug.
So what's your number six, Teresa?
So number six is that with our topic of things that Teresa worries about, sixth is why I don't actually worry. I don't worry about anything. And that's because if there's meaning in anything, there's meaning in everything. So it's possible that there is no meaning, that everything's just chaos and everything has just, we've hoisted ourselves into existence through monkey genes and, millennia of trial and error. But that's not what I find in my own life. What I find in my own life is I look back at just little things and big things and say, wow, what are the odds that that would have been just a coincidence, that that would have just happened that way, that I feel like in doing this research right now on my book, it's almost as if by the time that I formulate the question, it's like putting out my hand and that the answer drops like a ripe apple into my hand, that all I need to do is figure out the right question. And at that point, I end up being led step by step to say, oh, well, what about this? And what about this? And what about this? And one of the most dramatic examples of that in my life has been a topic that I know you and I have talked about before, is looking at the world wars and what really happened in the world wars. And I have one post called My Hitler Journey that chronicles all of the different ones from where I started, which was asking an innocent question. It was saying, okay, we all know about the Weimar hyperinflation and the terrible conditions that were put in. And so how in the world did Germany go from that to being self-reliant at a point that, nope, they weren't invading anybody? There was no one subjugated. They were just doing the work, and they ended up becoming this economic powerhouse. How did that happen? And that led me step by step by step by step to unravel. It's like pulling one thread on a sweater, and one thing just keeps on going to another. So that when I talk about the arguments and why arguments are so important to have on the same side. On one of my articles, Julia Skulefish, your friend and mine, posted about Hitler, and he looked at like the Dresden as a burnt offering, and posted many things talking about the economic genius of Hitler. And then at the same time, a reader called Nefahotep posted some things from Firebomb, Firebomber, Firestarter, I think it was. And he said Hitler made all these military mistakes that can't just have been mistakes, that they were ways of sabotaging the Germans. And I looked at both of those and I said, they both have good points. They both seem true. How could that be possible? And then, continuing in my recent work, I started looking at a guy named Gottfried Feder and found out that Feder was actually the genius behind the economic system, and that Hitler's father's name was Schicklgruber. So if a son takes his father's name, Hitler's name would be Schicklgruber, or Heidler, but would not be Hitler, and that his father's upbringing was supported by a wealthy Jewish family up until the time he was 18, because the father was born out of wedlock and to a 41-year-old mother who was a house cleaner in potentially Rothschild's home. Maybe not, but someone. And that what I found by putting all these clues together is that I believe that Schicklgruber was an actor who was an agent for Rothschild and was brought in order to sabotage. And he even imitates, Fader has the iconic mustache. He even imitates that mustache, and he becomes this voice for the people, and ends up twisting the whole system, and again making these military errors, and even rearmament was something that the people didn't want. But he ends up doing everything that just serves Germany back to England on a platter.
The city of London, yeah.
Yep, to the city of London.
Yeah. Well, it's yeah, that's one of the things that people don't realize is that, I always say, Germany was, occupied, colonized, and Weimarized by the master race. I mean, they literally took control of that country. And Hitler took it back, and they didn't like that. And they had 50% of all of the high level, high ranking government and business positions. He took away, I think he did, he got rid of interest rates, right? He took interest rates away from the banks, or that's why their economic miracle happened after he came to power, is because he literally got rid of the city of London, or at least defanged them. At least
See,
defanged them.
from my research, that's not true. It
Okay.
was Fader who
Oh.
did all of those
Well,
things.
okay.
And then Hitler ends up, they pay the president, who was the German general who hated the fact that World War I, that he was going to offer peace, that Kaiser Wilhelm was going to offer peace after he had won with no reparations
Yeah,
and no annexations. And this general, Ludendorff, and also I forget who became the president, but they didn't like that. They wanted to keep on fighting because the Rothschilds had loaned all the money
on
for
both
them to
sides.
go on both sides.
That's what
And
they did.
if there was peace with no reparations, they wouldn't get repaid. And so that's why they end up offering 3 million marks to the president to appoint Hitler as the Reichskanzler.
Okay.
So and then Hitler gets rid of Fader, puts in Schock, I think it is, and he had said, "Oh, this is going to be the ruin because Fader wants to kick out the bankers, and we don't want that." And so it was the wealthy industrialist that he brought back in. So from my research now, I've actually come to a point of saying, okay, both are true, that Germany did all of these great things to recover their economy, but the job of Hitler or Schicklgruber was to go in and sabotage it.
That's really interesting. I don't know if you have read them, but there's a book and a sequel that I think they transform my arc of awareness about the 20th century, and that is Dougherty and MacGregor. It's two Scottish guys wrote Hidden History. And about the secrets of, the origins of World War One. And then they, from an ink from an from an from a Western standpoint, that the sequel is prolonging the agony, how the Anglo-Americans prolonged World War One 3.5 years, basically thanks to Churchill and who and Woodrow Wilson, who was about as smart as Truman. And the whole thing was organized. I mean, World War One was like a US football game plan, I mean, they had it all mapped out how they were going to destroy Germany, and they did. And when the Germans were winning, the Germans sued for, they wanted a treaty, but Churchill, just kept pumping soldiers. And then, what's a Gallipoli? He sacrificed 50,000 of his own people to impress the Russians. Look what we're doing, to keep the Russians in the war. And so he sacrificed 50,000 British, well, mainly Australian soldiers in Gallipoli. And I mean, those two books by Doherty and MacGregor are just mind blowing. And it was the Queen. It was Queen Elizabeth, and it was the Rothschilds. And, it's just, and of course, Cecil Rhodes, before he died. And after he died, all his minions were Haldane and all these other, these imperial bloodlust, warmongering, megalomaniacs, who couldn't, they couldn't compete honestly on a level playing field with the Germans. So let's just destroy them. And that's exactly what they did.
Yeah, I was shocked to realize that bombing behind into civilian cities was something that before World War II didn't happen. There was a sense of honor. You were fighting on the front lines, and that you didn't even think about trying to go and getting those civilian cities. And then Churchill, for the very first time, does that in order to goad Hitler to bomb
Yeah,
London,
to bomb London.
because the excitement for continuing the war was flagging. But now I look at that and I think that was Hitler's role. It wasn't like he was supposed to retaliate, that they did that action in order to give him a way publicly of saying, well, now we have to do this. And so he played his role by retaliating, and he did not do what perhaps Iran is doing now and saying, I'm not going to take the bait. This will only they're only trying to get us to be able to do this thing so that they have an excuse, and they don't really care. But Churchill, it's the same thing. He didn't care about England. He didn't care how many of the English he ends up sacrificing, because to them, this is just a burnt offering.
Satanism, burnt offerings, the occult, the Illuminati. I mean, people sit there and go, oh, that's not true. But it is. I mean, you just have to look at the West and just see how it functions, to see what's going on. And in my WeChat forum that I have, someone put up a TikTok, or I can't remember what, but and it was just a little short clip of 2 or 3 minutes of all, if you want fame in Hollywood, if you want fame in New York, you have to sell your soul to the devil. And just showing clips of singers going, oh, so, and Lady Gaga, she was covering one of her eyes in an outtake for a video. Why are you covering your eye? Because I worship Lucifer. I mean, that's this is this is I sure hope the Chinese don't have to go through this, to get fame. So,
Yeah. And
the
again,
occult is
it's
a
all,
big deal. The occult is a big deal in the
yeah.
West.
And it's all again been inverted. So Satan comes from originally the cult of Set. And Set was the Egyptian fratricidal god that ends up killing his brother and taking over power and destroying everything. And so Set is who the pharaohs, many of them had Set in their name. So they were all, and in the Bible, that becomes Seth because it's both the same name. So it's actually pronounced Seeth. So that has been again inverted, where they made the good person, they made the hero into Seth. He's the one heir who gets control of the world after Cain has been smeared by being told that he's killed Abel. But it's really Seth who ends up inheriting everything. But Seth is the original name for who becomes Satan. And who Satan in the Bible was actually the zealots who were fighting against the empire. So it's all twisted.
That's really interesting. Well, the occult, I saw. Did you see the painting that King Charles had made of him, his portrait? And
No.
it's all it's just the English, the English king, and it's just sick, and it's all red and bloody. And then someone showed how there's like this sort of like this design in the lower, in one of the corners of it. And if you take the painting and flip it upside down, the other corner, matches up with the original. And it's actually the head, it's the head of what's the goat devil called?
Right.
Baphomet? Yeah. It's actually the head of Baphomet. I mean, it's just like,
Wow. Yeah.
it's just unbelievable. It's frightening.
The occult signaling these days is off the hook.
Oh, I know.
And this is why. This is why. Because part of the whole magical belief is that in order for something to be a worthy sacrifice, you have to give them a chance to figure it out. And so they have to be choosing. They have to be a willing sacrifice. And that's why they give us so many hints. That's why things are in plain sight, because if we then don't figure it out, it's because at some level we are willing to be sacrificed. And that's why I think we need to be paying a lot of attention. Right now, I don't think we're at a time of action. I think we're at a time of intense observation and putting our ideas together. What I think of as my blog is collaborative research, that when I post a video and my text, it's only half done, that the other half of it happens in the comment thread.
It's really interesting because in China, in Chinese civilization, there's no devil. I mean, there's good and there's evil, and there are gods, but not particularly one god, but there's a lot of gods, that got fused into Buddhism, the earth god, the money god, the fertility goddess, the kitchen god, the land god, that all got fused into Buddhism and Taoism and Confucianism for that matter. That there's no cloven-hooved, horned, red devil. There's just the concept of evil. And so in Chinese culture, that evil is not personified. And I think that it's a good thing, to be
I
honest with
agree.
you.
Yeah, I agree.
This whole idea, Baphomet, a goat-headed bisexual, whatever, evil, it's just the whole thing is just nuts. And I think that's why Chinese civilization is so much more relaxed and calm and less contentious and more cooperative, because we don't have this, this gigantic, at the God level, at the, at the pantheon level. China does not have this, good God, evil, Satan, duking it out, and I think it has had a very beneficial impact on Chinese culture.
I agree. I think that the concept of evil, of good versus evil, that duality is judgment. It's judging that someone, that you are better than someone else. And I see that superiority as what enables people to take power over others, because they say, oh, well, we need good people to be in charge. And so that, rather than looking at the acts, and so I define doing bad as causing harm, but doing evil is causing others to cause harm. Because then you're not only multiplying how much harm you're doing, but you have to kill the soul of the person who then is going to be directly doing that harm. So you're killing two with that step. So that kind of evil of power over others and using that power to cause harm is how I define evil.
Oh, go ahead. If you
Oh,
want to
just
finish
that
up.
I think we need to take that power away rather than.
Rather than let them have power over us,
Or rather than trying to decide, okay, let's get rid of all the evil people. That instead of that, if you can take the power away from those people in order to do evil, because they no longer have the power over others. So that again is what my economic system does, is that it says, okay, I'm not going to give you the power to usurp ownership of all the homes and therefore own all of our labor. I'm not going to take away the money you have now. You just can't control all of us by controlling the homes. And by doing that, you release all of those people from that role that they're playing.
That brings up something else I was thinking about. I always talk about this in some of my writings, is that Western philosophy is based on morals, and morals is my religion is different than yours, and my religion is better than yours. And my rules trump your rules. And so you need to do my rules because they're better than your rules. Whereas in Chinese culture, civilization, it's all based on that negative golden rule. It's based on ethics. It's not based on morals. And it's that don't do unto others what you do not want done to you. And that starts with the emperor, and it goes down to the generals, and it goes down to the governors, and it goes down to the mayors, and it goes down to the judges. Is it perfect? No, there's been tons of corruption and terrible things happened in China. But that, I don't want to say it, that ideal that everything is based on the negative golden rule is omnipresent. And people who have a responsibility, whether it's a father, a mother, or a governor, or Mao Zedong, they always had that pressure to live by the negative gold. And I'm going to start saying that, the negative golden rule. So
I
that's the
think
big
that's
difference.
absolutely true, that if you have a system of anarchy, meaning rule by rules, not by rulers, you don't have archons who
Yeah.
are ruling, that you are instead making the rules, I think that you can actually make any rules you want as long as you can flip them. You know, if you look at it as an algebra equation, if you can take this one over here and say, okay, if that's fair for us, then is that fair for you?
Yeah.
And no matter how you write the rules, it doesn't matter as long as it's the same for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. My gosh, we've been going on for a while here. Do you have any closing comments, Teresa? This has been terrific. Everybody needs to buy her book. Everybody needs to subscribe to her Substack. And I will put all this information in the interview page for her. And I'm really glad to have her back. This has been one of the best interviews I've done in quite a while. So I've really enjoyed it. And I think it's going to be very informative. And I hope you'll share it on Substack when I get it transcribed and edited and
Absolutely.
everything. And any closing comments, my dear?
Just to say thank you. And it is such a pleasure to talk with you because we get to go in so many wide-ranging places. And I just love that you have such a breadth of interest and are
All the
such
way
a.
across the Pacific.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you, Teresa. Bye-bye. I unfortunately I've lost my Buddhist brace. You know, I study Buddhism, and but I without my Buddhist bracelet, I will give you a Buddhist bow and thank you.